Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, I'm James Allison, and you're listening to Beyond the Grid.
Hello, everyone. Tom Clarkson here, and welcome once again to Beyond the Grid, presented by Bose Quiet Comfort 35-2 wireless headphones. This week, I'm speaking to one of the most thoughtful and articulate people in F1. During his 30-year career as an engineer, he's worked for most of the big guns in the pit lane, including Ferrari, Renault, and of late, Mercedes. I'm talking about the Silver Arrows technical director, James Allison. Now, you won't find a more modest man in the pit lane. James doesn't like to be singled out from the team around him, but that's what we're going to do in this episode. With a record-breaking 412s to start the 2019 season, Mercedes have raised the bar once again, both technically and operationally. And James should take much of the credit for that, even if he'd always immediately deflect it back to those around him. We caught up at Mercedes HQ in Brackley, where we had the chance to spend a good hour face-to-face. I can safely say that he didn't disappoint. So get ready for some fascinating insights into the winning machine that is the modern Silver Arrows, along with some cracking anecdotes about Lewis Hamilton, Valtteri Bottas, and more. Well, James, welcome to Beyond the Grid. It's lovely to have you on the show. And what a fantastic time to be here in Brackley, just after the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. There's a buzz about this place. You guys are going quite well this year.
We are going quite well, but you might not believe it, but within like an hour or two of winning a race, you start worrying about the next one. So the happiness is there bubbling away in the background, but mostly it's just anxiety. And excitement too. But tell us
what happens after a race win. Does it bubble away in the foreground? I mean, do you guys come here? Does the champagne flow on a Monday after a victory?
You really can tell when you walk in. You could not watch the weekend. You could come in the factory and know whether we had done well or not, because the mood of the building is palpable. So you can for sure say when we've had a good one, and people will be full of smiles and keen to meet your eye, and you know, there's just an energy to the place. In terms of formal things that we do when we win, we do give everyone a glass of champagne during the debrief that we have in front of the whole staff during the day. But there isn't sort of riotous celebration or anything.
Now, look, one of my take-home things from the Baku Grand Prix was that first corner between Valtteri and Lewis. And I think it does beg the question, are you nervous that the good vibes between those two, if it does become a championship fight between them, could it get a bit edgy?
Well, you know? Certainly incredibly nervous that as they jostle for position on the track, where necessarily they get very, very close to one another, you're very nervous that neither of them is making a misjudgment that might lead to them touching. And then, you know, the disaster that follows from that. But we're all very conscious that a huge asset for this team over the last couple of seasons and over the beginning of this one has been the relationship between our two drivers. They know it. We know it, and all of us would like that to stay the way it is. But we also know that the dynamic between drivers and the team is a fragile thing and needs nurturing. So I think the whole team is very conscious of the need to preserve that, including the drivers themselves, because they know it works for everybody.
Okay, and looking at the bigger picture, 4 1-2s, consecutive 1-2s this year. How do you guys continue to raise the bar?
Well, that's not a one-word answer. There's 1,000 people here just at Brackley, and there's, you know, a very large operation down the road in Brixworth as well, covering the broadest range of disciplines. And all of this team has been enjoying a period of near unprecedented success in the sport. That success is certainly not an accident, but it isn't down to one thing. It's down to just hundreds and hundreds and thousands of things that all add up to the competence that you see on the track. But we have had a few things that have been strongly in our favour. We've got a brilliant driver lineup. We have an extremely good level of budget from all our partners and from our owners. We have a sort of maturity in the team that's had a degree of stability that is extremely unusual. Normally, a team that has been as successful as this gets systematically picked apart by our competitors, who want to both have good people and also disrupt the team in the process. We've enjoyed stability for a long period of the core part of the team. And perhaps above all else, the team has really, really cared about not being complacent and about having humility. These sound very soft in a world of F1, which is quite a sort of bustling, hard-edged world sometimes. The softness of saying we have humility, we're not going to get complacent, is such a weapon. If you can really live that out rather than just say the words, then it means that it's true that a few hours after a glorious 1-2 in Baku, you start worrying about the next one and start thinking, well, you know, we're a bit fortunate this weekend in some regards. It was a lovely, lovely end result, but let's remember there's been 4 races. Only 2 of those races were we really strong. The other 2, one we should have taken a pasting, in Baku we could easily have been beaten. And we're about to go to Spain, where we got an absolute roosting in winter testing. So that humility is in the bones of the place. And it's a very, very strong asset.
And it comes from the top, from people like you, Toto.
Fortunately, it's embedded across the company, but it is certainly led from the front by Toto. And there is a critical mass of people who really truly believe it, that allows the whole organization to be imbued with that spirit.
And how much designing do you do now as the technical boss, or are you purely managing people?
I do precisely none. and in fact, it's one of the things that makes me so uncomfortable when people talk about, this is your last year, it was my first full year in the team, this is the first Allison car, and you just cringe internally because although the sport puts personalities, they put a face to a team, and through that face, people can sort of talk about a team. The truth is that each individual plays the smallest role in a thing like this. And I just said to you, I do no designing, none. I hope I play a part in the team that is you know, worth my salt, but the idea that a single person is the architect of a car is just errant nonsense.
So on a serious note, do you bounce from meeting to meeting trying to steer the different departments?
Not quite, no. I do bounce from meeting to meeting. The probably half to two-thirds of my working life is attending meetings. And in some of those meetings, they are key decision-making meetings where the people in that meeting are trying to set up some of the strategic things that will sort of set out our stall for the coming races and the coming seasons. And in that, I clearly have a voice, but I'm one voice amongst many experienced engineers. And only when there is just no obvious direction emerging that we can coalesce around, do I actually end up having to say, look, okay, enough, we're going to do this. But luckily in a team like this with the quality and quantity of people in it that have been doing it a while, have good judgment and are not ego driven. Most of the time, these decisions make themselves, and all that is necessary is that we all just put our shoulders to the wheel.
And how different is all that compared to, I don't know, when you're at LaRousse, head of aero at LaRousse, what, 93, 1993, 94? Yeah. I mean, like, how many people? You said there are 1,000 people here at Brackley.
Yeah.
How many people were in the whole of the LaRousse Formula One team 25 years ago?
Well, the LaRousse Formula One team was divided into two parts. There was a race team, and then there was a technical office. And the race team was a French racing team, owned and run by Gerard LaRousse, and he commissioned the manufacture and design of the car to a small office of engineers in Bicester, who were LaRousse UK. And I think there were about, it's hard to remember the precise numbers, but maybe 15 of us, something like that, if you include the receptionist.
The technical department. Yeah.
And the aero department was me and two model makers. And we were, of course, truly appalling because you can't be anything other than that with so few people. But equally, truly remarkable to make a Formula One car that would actually sometimes finish a race, occasionally steal a point when there were points only down to sixth place with so little was a Herculean achievement and a great, enjoyable blast to be doing that in
age 25 or whatever you were at the time.
Yeah, 24, 25 and just living the dream. It was great.
We say living the dream. I mean, James, why? I mean, let's just wind the clock back a little bit. Why Formula One for you? Because tell me if I'm wrong, but reading a few things about you, there's no motor racing history in your family. It's much more aeroplanes.
There's no motor racing, but there's lots of machinery in my family and a love for things that mankind makes and uses. And my dad was a fighter pilot in the Air Force and liked old cars and brought me up helping him to mend the things that he couldn't really afford to own and used to break quite a lot that we used to go flying in.
What did your dad fly? You say he was a fighter pilot.
When I was born, he was on Lightnings. Then I guess for the majority of the bits I remember as a boy, he was on Phantoms. And then after I left home, he moved on to Tornadoes. So, yeah.
And was that the first love for you, was aeroplanes? I said to you aged 13, what do you want to be when you grow up? You would have said...
I would have said, I would like to be a fighter pilot like my dad. But I would have also said, but I'm colorblind, but I'm hoping to cheat my way through the tests if I knew you really well.
When did you find out you were colorblind?
Oh, pretty early on when I was 10 or 11. Yeah.
Because there is a story I'm aware of you trying to, as you say, cheat your way through the Ishihara test, right?
Yeah. For people who don't know what an Ishihara test is, it's these tests where there's lots of coloured dots and you try to say what number is on the coloured dots. And if you're colourblind, you just can't see it. But what you can see, if you've got a certain type of colourblindness, is you can see a number they're trying to spoof you into saying. So typically, they will make a pattern that to a colourblind person looks like a 7, let's say, but actually it's a 3. And if you look at the top of a number 7, it's got the same shape as a number 3. But then once it gets sort of halfway down, 7s and 3s start looking different. And for the colorblind person, they will trace a pattern that only a colorblind person can see that makes it scream 7 at you. And for a non-colorblind person, it's blindingly obvious that it's a 3. So if I saw a 7, I'd say, oh, 3, and vice versa.
How far did you get?
Well, that trick can work, but there is a sort of moment of computation, and some of them are not as cleanly and clearly translatable as the 7-3 example. But there is a moment of sort of thinking about it before you say it. And even though the test, you're supposed to get 5 seconds and it's supposed to be done in good light, the test is more of a screening process than a definitive test. And annoyingly, the doctor could see I was doing too much thinking. And so he gave me the definitive test, which I failed magnificently. And so I wasn't allowed to be what I'd hoped I could be.
And how much of a setback was that?
Well, it was pretty crushing at the time because because that's what I thought I'd want to be. When I look back on it now, I think it was the most awesome blessing, because I think that the life that I have subsequently been granted to have was just infinitely more diverse, enjoyable, and challenging. And that's not to denigrate the life of an RAF fighter pilot, which is exciting and challenging and awesome. I saw my dad do it, and there's, I think there's huge things to recommend it. But I've been very, very lucky in what I've done, and have had the best time doing it.
Was it quite a nomadic childhood? Was Dad posted all over the world, or did you have to follow him? Or?
He was. So we had periods in America, periods in Lincolnshire, periods in Norfolk, in London, in Germany, moving jobs on average every 2.5 years or so, and moving schools with it until to my secondary school age, where my dad and my mum kept moving around, but my schooling was constant because I went to a boarding school.
And first job was what, polishing shoes? I don't know what does son of a military person do for a first job? Did you get involved in any way?
What you mean, like a casual labour type
job?
Yeah,
during the holidays.
Okay, the first job I had that I was paid for was printing, because this was one of the Lincolnshire phases, so rural Lincolnshire, there's a shitload of potatoes to be harvested. And I had a job where I got paid £1 per 1,000 potato sacks, printing with a sort of stamp where you put it in the ink and then put it on the potato sack, printing the name of the type of potato on the sack. And that was my
first
job.
Are you an authority on potato? Well, we needn't go there. So the Formula One thing, what happened next? How did you get involved? So you went to Cambridge University and studied engineering,
yeah. And I was doing a postgraduate year that I wasn't enjoying. I loved my undergraduate degree, but once that was over, I started doing a master's, didn't really like it that much, and thought I'd much rather get a job. Most of my friends were either had headed off into the city to work there or were planning to, and that left me very cold. And I'd been sponsored through university by Dunlop Aviation, and had spent my summer holidays not finding myself in India, but working in Coventry, learning how to draw, learning how to machine things, and having a really brilliant time, actually. And that sponsorship by that company left me utterly convinced that I wanted to be an engineer. But good to me though they were, I was more attracted to the engineering that was possible inside Formula One than the sort of traditional engineering that was possible in some of the other companies in the country. And I'd always been a fan of F1, and I just thought, well, I'm an engineer. I really like Formula One. I want to stay being an engineer. Perhaps if I'm really lucky, they might take a look at me. So I wrote a load of letters and luckily got one reply.
One reply from the Benetton.
I got one reply from Benetton.
Not one reply. Was it really one reply?
I got two replies. I got one from McLaren saying, thanks, we've put it in our filing system. And then one from Benetton saying, why don't you come down for an interview? And it turned out that my application had arrived on their desk as the first of many people applying for a job that coincidentally they had advertised that week in Autosport for a junior draftsman. And so my letter, which was pitched nicely for such a task, but wholly by chance, was the first one to come across their bows. And I got lucky with that.
And you got lucky. And so that was the sort of Tom Walkinshaw era, wasn't it? And,
that was the John Barnard era. There was a short period between Rory Byrne and Pat Simmons, where Flavio had sort of invested in John Barnard. There was the factory was split across two sites, one up in Whitney, one down in Godalming near John Barnard's house. And I was hired into that. And then a year or so later, it became the Ross Braun era with Pat Simmons and Rory Byrne and co coming back from exile to work under him.
And did you know immediately that you'd made the right decision and you were happy in Formula One and you found the work interesting?
It was brilliant right from the start, and it stayed brilliant all the way through. As a way of life, it takes a lot from you, but it gives massively in return. You get to work with strong characters who almost to a person are nice people. There are a few sharks kicking around, but most of the engineering community is extremely optimistic, fun, exciting, adventurous people who make your working life extremely enjoyable. And the challenges that are put in front of you are nearly always difficult, but they're normally doable in some form or another, and they never ever dull.
Who have been the biggest influences on you professionally?
I guess I've been lucky to work for some splendid people along the way. From an engineering point of view, the biggest ones have been Bob Bell, who I worked with sort of alongside at Benetton, and then worked for when he was my technical director when I came back to that same team, but when they were then Renault. Ross Brawn, who I was lucky enough to work for during those glory years at Ferrari and also previously at Benetton, although he probably didn't know I was working for him back then. but by the time we got to Ferrari, I was playing a slightly more important role. And his leadership style and his calmness were things I definitely learned a lot from. Those are probably the two biggest engineering figures that I've worked with.
And what about your favourite era? Because you've sort of, you know, we've talked about LaRousse and the challenge of having a, you know, a group of 15, 20 people pulling things together. In terms of from a regulation point of view, what have you enjoyed the most?
This is going to sound really boring, but I've enjoyed all of it. I mean, all of it. Even years that were enduringly grim, there's still plenty to recommend them as life experiences. But people often ask me, oh, what's your favourite car? You know, what was your favourite race? And I think one of the abiding characteristics of motor racing is that everything that's happened is almost almost overnight uninteresting. What matters is what's coming next. And are you ready for the next race? Are you going to be ready for the next season? Is the group of people you're with building strength and moving in the right direction? The cars themselves, once they're not animated by a championship, they're just pretty lumps of titanium and plastic and rubber and
amazing.
Aluminium.
You're sounding like a driver in your sort of outlook towards it. I always think that, I don't know, I thought I was expecting a little bit more sentimentality, I suppose. You know, a car that you've maybe had particular success with or...
I don't think of them in those terms. I don't. I'm hugely sentimental about the sport and the people I have been lucky enough to work alongside, and the sense of comradeship that being in a team brings you, and that sense of camaraderie is something which has had peaks and troughs depending on how fortunate you were to be in a team that really understood it, or teams that perhaps sort of said the right things but didn't live it. And in that respect, I've been in some pretty good places, but this place is truly remarkable in that regard.
This place, Mercedes.
Mercedes, yeah.
Do you think the regulations now are too restrictive?
No, I wouldn't say that particularly. People sometimes, I think, look back at the sport and pick out some big innovations. You know, you'll hear people talking about the Brabham fan car or the twin chassis cars of the past.
Or the forward-facing exhausts.
You know, there's any number of things that you can pick out as big features. And they say, see, there's no innovation in Formula One. But if they were to come and live alongside us and see the way in which the teams, the engineers in the teams and the teams find lap time in the most unlikely of little holes, you know, it's an unending work of invention and skill. And in many ways, the sort of invention and skill that these rules force upon you is the invention and skill of the sort of prisoner of war escape artist, who is constrained by all manner of appalling things that is trying to keep him penned in, but the ingenuity is what breaks free, and that ingenuity is writ large across hundreds and hundreds of details in the car, which add up to a lot of lap time. And so I actually think the rules are a way of almost bringing the best out of people to find the opportunity when there's seemingly none.
Do you find it intellectually stimulating what you do? Because the reason I'm asking that question is I read somewhere that you'd said you've never been as challenged academically anyway as you were when you were at Cambridge, and Formula One hasn't had the same demands intellectually. Do you still feel that?
Well, there's two different words there, aren't there? There's intellectual and academically.
Academic, yeah.
And there's no doubt that the environment of a Cambridge degree is academically quite challenging, and they ask a lot of you in that regard. But the intellectual challenge of being in a Formula One team is vastly richer than an academic than an undergraduate academic degree. The breadth of challenge, both technical and human, is so much richer than that. It asks searching questions of you all the time, and it asks them of you very often when you're on your knees with fatigue. And one of the things that is thrilling in its own way is when you're surrounded by hundreds of people who have given way more than they're contracted to give for month after month after month, and you can see them there, pallid and unwell looking, sunken-eyed, greasy-haired, spotty, and yet the thing that they're doing together is breathtaking. And the way in a good team, despite that fatigue, people keep being nice to one another and keep their minds on the overall task and don't lose their temper and don't start throwing their toys out the pram, that really makes you feel part of something special when you have people who understand the bigger picture, even when they are utterly riven with fatigue.
Talk of being part of something special. Can you just shed some light on what it was like to win everything with Ferrari in the early noughties?
That was pretty good. it was lovely.
And are there comparisons to be made with what you're going through now?
There are comparisons. I'd say there's differences too. First of all, it was extremely exciting for me because up until that point, I had a factory-based existence. And my role at Ferrari was the first time I'd been exposed to the track. And being at the pointy end of a racing car team when you haven't previously opens your eyes quite wide. And there's the thrill and the immediacy of the hoopla attached to a victory and the ups and downs that happen in a very intense way at a track. And so that emotional roller coaster was something I was experiencing for the first time. There was also something pretty special about being in Ferrari when they broke their drought, that I think it had been 27 years or something without a championship at the point where Michael did it in 2000. And when we got off the plane in Bologna, there were 1,000 or so people waiting in the airport to greet us, and not friends and family. They were there as well, but there were just a huge chanting throng with a giant Scuderia flag, and it was quite a thrill. Although people remember that as a period of utter dominance, there were two seasons that were utterly dominating, but there were also some pretty challenging ones where we had to really fight for it. So that was great. But with the benefit of hindsight, I can also see that those victories were, there was a degree of asymmetry in the teams back then, that Ferrari was the biggest team, the biggest budget, and it wasn't that close either. It had an utterly magnificent driver. And the teams that we were beating off and winning against in some ways were not the same size of endeavor that Ferrari, you know, the sort of war machine that Ferrari had put together. I think one of the things that makes the era that Mercedes finds itself in and has prospered in more remarkable is that there are some real titans to beat. The three top teams, they are all extremely professional, extremely well-funded, extremely strong organizations. And for anyone in that climate to win, they've done a very fine job. And so for Mercedes to do it a number of years on the trot, it merits a degree of recognition.
What about the guys you've worked for over the years? I mean, how much contact did you have with Todd when you were at Ferrari, Jean Todt? Or was Ross very much the point of contact?
Of course, if you're one of the traveling community, then each of the meetings that happens during the race weekend, and you probably know that race weekends are punctuated by an enormous string of meetings before the session, after the session, before the next session, after the next session. And Jean would be in the majority of those meetings. So it's impossible not to be near Jean a lot if you're part of the traveling community. But that didn't mean that he was regularly pulling me into his office saying, "Hey, James, what do you think about this?" It was very clear to all of us who were at Ferrari in that period that Jean was the team principal and that he worked very hard for us. He put a big shell around the company that kept all of the extraneous noise that can sometimes drag Ferrari down, that just kept that away. He just put a huge umbrella over the place. He was very decisive in acting on things to keep the team running smoothly. So if he could see that there was a friction in the team, he would either intervene to put it right, or if it was clear that a person was just a troublemaker, then he would pull them out of the fray and then they wouldn't be a troublemaker anymore because they wouldn't be in the fray. Mm. So he was very decisive in that fashion. He's also someone who you could be pretty sure if it was 9:30 at night and you were still working in the wind tunnel or whatever, you could be pretty sure that he'd be around at some point that night and he would just wander around and ask you how you were going. And it was, you know, a classic case of management by walking about rather than that he knew what wind tunnel guys were up to or anything. But he knew a lot of people's names. He knew a lot about their lives and would make a big effort to make sure that the team was rolling along nicely.
Can we say the same about your previous boss, Flavio Briatore?
Flav wasn't quite in that style of management, no. Flav sort of rather subbed that out to people like Bob Bell and Pat. Pat looked after the race team and Bob basically ran the company from a factory side. Well, Flav, it's not to say that Flav was not important. He was hugely important to the arc of Benetton and then Renault. But he wasn't a sort of hands-on figure and certainly not the type of person who'd wander around talking to anyone.
And then when you went back to Ferrari in 2013, how different was the place to your previous stint at the team?
It was pretty different because that shell that I described that Jean had erected around the Formula One team that made it feel like a racing car team, that had been depleted over the years, and there was a lot more tugging of strings that were coming from outside of the race team that made the job of the team more complex. You know, it just made it more pressured and more difficult, and where decisions were not necessarily always taken at the right level in the company, you know, by the level that understood the thing it was making the decision about. So it had the tendency to make the company react to short-term pressure a bit more, whereas it needs to, a Formula One team needs to have stability, it needs to make calm decisions, and it needs sometimes to hold its nerve even when things look bleak, because the sport is difficult, and it's because it is so much easier to make things worse by intervening than make them better. So actions to intervene need to be carefully calibrated and carefully measured, and that requires a sort of steady hand on the tiller for a number of seasons. And I think one of the interesting things looking at Ferrari now is that I think they sort of get it. I think you see a resolve in the team that we're up against this season. They know that they have some assets that are going to grow into something strong if they can hold their nerve and do the right thing. And they have a fast car and they have some extremely good people. And it's just a question of keeping cool, not panicking.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And things will come to them.
Some wonderful insight from James so far, but we're going to press pause on our chat for just a minute to give a mention to Harry's, the online razor company, which might just be able to transform your morning routine with their thoughtfully made shaving tools and well-rounded skincare for every man. And good news for Beyond the Grid listeners, Harry's are offering you the chance to get your hands on a trial set for just £3.95. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/F1podcast. These trial sets are fantastic and the perfect way to test out if Harry's is right for you. Just enter your details online and you'll get a neat little package delivered to your door with all you need to get going, including a weighted ergonomic handle ensuring maximum comfort and grip while you shave, and 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade. Harry's also throw in a foaming shave gel and a handy little travel blade cover to protect your kit. All of that for £3.95. High quality blades for half the price of other brands out there. Now, you know the drill by now. If you haven't already, then get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support our podcast and you get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, 5 blade cartridge, foaming shave gel and travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/F1podcast. Right now, that's harrys.com/F1podcast. Now let's get back to James. When you've spent so much time at a rival, in your case, Ferrari, do you feel, you know so many of the people there, you know Mattia Binotto, for example, very well. Do you kind of feel you can imagine quite accurately what's going on and how they're developing the car because you know the characters behind it so well? Does that help you here?
I don't particularly try to second guess them in that way. The weird thing about being in F1 is that you can have extremely deep feelings of affection towards a place and people. I have many, many, many friends in Ferrari, and that affection can genuinely sit alongside a rabid desire to crush them into the ground. And it's a strange thing. And they would do exactly the same to me, despite the fact that we've enjoyed many things together and I want nothing but good things to happen to them.
So you've worked with some brilliant technical people, but you've also worked with some great drivers. And I just wanted to ask you, I mean, there are very few people in the pit lane who have worked with the list of great drivers that you've worked with. And I'm thinking, so looking at my list here, Lewis Hamilton, Michael Schumacher, Fernando Alonso, Kimi Raikkonen, and Sebastian Vettel, you've worked with them all. And what made each of them special? And can we start with Lewis?
I'm not sure that I could give you a happy list of driver by driver what their defining specialness is.
What is it about Lewis that impresses you?
Well, first of all, they are all impressive people. Yeah, they're all, if you take the great sort of smudge of humanity, drivers are not in the middle. They're way off in the far distance somewhere at one extreme end of the bell curve of humans. They are not normal in their attitude to life and their willingness to give themselves to a very hard task that requires minute level of detailed attention and caring about winning way beyond what someone who thinks they're competitive cares. So they're all unusual people, but sort of take that as a given. That's there for all of them. So the thing that has both surprised me. So one thing I was expecting when I came to Mercedes was I was expecting to find a fast driver in Lewis, because you've only got to look at his stats to know that he didn't get them by accident. he is insanely fast. And interestingly, for someone who is not in the first flush of youth now in driving terms, he's still a pole position machine, which that doesn't tend to be as true as a driver gets a few seasons under his belt. And Lewis is blisteringly quick in qualifying. So I was expecting to be impressed by that, and boy, am I. I think the other thing that I was expecting to be impressed by, but have come to appreciate more, is just how cleverly he races a car and how cleanly he races a car. He makes other people make mistakes by placing his car in a place on the road where they have no choice except to hit him or to back down or to make a mistake, while he doesn't. You know, he just places a car in a place on the road immaculately but cleanly.
Is a case in point Vettel in Bahrain?
A more perfect example, in my opinion, would be Monza last year, where going into
Sebastian again,
Lewis just put his car on the road, you know, not in a way that it was easy for Lewis to do, but just put his car on the road in a place where it left Sebastian with nowhere to go. And I just thought that was magnificent and you know, utterly clean. There was nothing about that. It wasn't like he didn't leave room or anything like that. It just brilliant driving.
What's he like as a bloke?
Well, I was going to say that those are the things I was sort of expecting, but when I see it for real, it's like, okay, I was expecting it, but it's more so. It's more and it's better. The thing I utterly was not expecting was the Lewis as a bloke part of it, because I'd had no interaction with him prior to coming to the team, and I sort of could see that he was much more of a superstar driver than the rest of the grid, with a much bigger public image, one which he to some degree cultivated via Twitter and stuff like that. And I was expecting to find someone who had a much more overpowering ego than the person I found, and have rather enjoyed finding someone who is pretty appealing as a character. Yeah, not like sort of Mother Teresa or anything, far from it, but a person whose values and behaviours are ones that I think most people would enjoy being alongside.
And do you think you only see that inside the team? Do you think the public image is different?
I think we're deeply fortunate to spend enough time with, you know, anyone who works at a track with the drivers is going to spend enough time with them that they're going to get beyond the sort of fluff of a press conference or the sort of cliches that tend to get mouthed from weekend to weekend, because the type of question that gets asked is quite repetitive and formulaic. And so the answers tend to be repetitive and formulaic as well. If you spend enough time with a person in the type of environment we're in, you get past that and you see the person beneath. But I mean, I've told this story before, but my introduction to Lewis was unusual, to say the least. But it was revealing about him in a way that has had an important bearing on his and my relationship since. So my first encounter with him as an employee of Mercedes was in the first winter test of 2017. And we'd been introduced in the morning, shaken hands, and made the sort of looking forward to working with you type noises. And then he'd gone off to do his thing. I'd gone off to do mine. And we didn't bump into each other until mid-morning of that day, where he had clambered out the car because we were doing something to it. And I was stood in the garage looking at some telemetry. And he walked over to me, I think just to be friendly. The run before, he'd been going around the track and he'd had quite a big moment in turn four where the back had come loose and he'd kept his foot down and caught it and carried on. And he came up to me and said, "Hey, did you see that moment in turn four?" And I was thinking, well, I sort of know the form here. You know, drivers like to be told how cool and brave they are. And they are quite cool and brave in many ways. You know, they do things that the rest of us would probably want a good old sit down afterwards. And they put it straight away to the back of their head and they push on. So I sort of know the deal that you need to say, yeah, that was massive. Wow. But equally, I didn't want my first interaction with Lewis to be a sort of fawning one. And so I rather unwisely said, yeah, I did see it. But the thing that always amazes me about you fuckers is that you come back for more of it the next lap. And in my mind, that was a sort of way of acknowledging in an indirect way that they are unusual people, that they do a dangerous thing, that they immediately put it out of their head and they come back around and do it more. But I wanted to say it in a way that didn't say like, oh, you're so cool. But it was like, there's something a bit wrong with you guys. That was what was going on in my head. But Lewis's face just...
Was he on the same page or not?
No, not at all. He just like, his face just fell. He looked sort of very surprised at me, turned on his heel and sort of walked off in the opposite direction. And I thought, oh, okay. He's not quite getting me. And a little bit later in the day, well, towards that evening, Toto came up to me and said, James, Lewis said you were pretty rude to him earlier. And I knew what he was talking about, but I also knew I hadn't been rude. I might have been ill-judged, but I wasn't rude. I make ill judgments. And I said, okay, I know what that was. I wasn't trying to be rude. I'll put it right. Don't worry. I'll go and have a chat with him. We didn't have an opportunity to talk to each other for the next day or so. And the first time we did come across each other was back in the factory. And he and I sort of bumped into each other and we sort of said, should we go downstairs for a coffee down in the canteen?
Bit of an atmosphere or not?
It was clear that both of us wanted to just
clear the
deal
air
with this. Because Toto absolutely would have said, Lewis, there's no harm in him. He's just got a potty mouth. You don't need to worry about that. And so it was just necessary to put it straight, not that there was going to be a row. And it was an opportunity to sit in a relaxed way. So we go sit downstairs and I sort of explained where I was coming from and said, but don't worry, you know, I won't do it again. And he said, no, don't fret, you know, carry on being you. It was just a weird thing to have as the first thing that someone ever said to you. And I thought, yeah, it probably was. But what then surprised me, and this is really the part of the story that is much, you know, is properly revealing of Lewis, is that he said to me, look, I haven't had a chance to say until now, but I just want to say how sorry I was about your wife, who had sadly died 6 or 8 months earlier. And he said, I'm truly, truly sorry. That's a terrible thing. And that completely caught me by surprise in a very welcome way, because a death of anyone you love is a massive thing. And it runs around your head. It still runs around my head today. There will not be 10 minutes of my life where I haven't thought of Becca since then. And it runs around your head continually. And it's a lonely sort of world where you're thinking about this pain and very few other people even remember that it happened, still less have the courage to acknowledge it and say it, because there's a lot of difficulty and embarrassment around, am I going to upset the person? Is it wrong? Is it right? But it's lovely when someone does have the courage to do that, because it's an acknowledgement of a loss that matters to you more than anything in the world. And it's a less lonely world when someone does acknowledge that. So, and it's certainly not what you expect from a driver. So it caught me by surprise and I said, no, thank you. And he sort of said, I don't know if it's something you want to talk about or not, but I just needed to say it. And I told him what I just told you about the fact that it's lovely when people do. And he took the conversation on a little bit and said, I hope that you find some way of learning to live with it. And I hope that in good time, you'll eventually find happiness again in the future, which is a lovely thing to say. And absolutely, again, not where I was expecting to be on a Monday morning in a canteen in a Formula One team talking to a Formula One driver who are not generally the most sensitive of souls. I was deeply grateful to it, but I was also aware that probably ought to find a way to bring it to a close in a grateful sort of way. And I said, well, I would dearly hope so too. But I, you know, that happy future that you set out, that would require me to actually start talking to a girl, and I'm pretty rubbish at that. And he looked at me and he smiled and he went, well, maybe just don't call them fuckers. so that
Uncle Lewis. Yeah,
that was and you know, that was sort of not day naught of our relationship, but it was at the start, and it mattered a lot to me. And I think that just in a small way, that shows you, you know, there's no cameras, there's no microphones, there's no one to show off to. That's just him being considerate and being emotionally literate in a way that people probably would not have anticipated. And it certainly enabled me to connect with him in the months and years since, and one thing that I'm grateful for.
Would you say that your relationship has evolved to such a point where you are a friend of Lewis Hamilton, or is it purely professional?
No, I wouldn't claim that at all. I hope that I certainly would wish him a good day and good things in his life, and I hope he would wish the same of me, but it's a professional relationship. I think the race engineer who works with him day in, day out is a closer bond than a technical director. But I think he and I, we have a trust that means that when he comes and says that this, I'm hurting here, this bit of the car needs to change, and if I say, I've heard you, believe me, we're working on it, he will know that I mean it, that it will happen, and that things will change in the direction that he's talking about. And similarly, I'm pretty sure that were I ever to need to have to say to him, Lewis, this is hurting the team, can you please do X, Y, or Z? He would hear me out and act in a way that was the right one.
James, what about other drivers? Michael Schumacher. People say he was there was very much a human side to him. I think Sabine Kem saying that he was very good at remembering people's birthdays in the team and
yeah.
Is it a common trait that we're starting to see across?
No, because drivers are not all like that by any means. I would say that...
Are good ones all like that?
No, not even the good ones. Michael was certainly someone who properly understood the power of a team and understood that acting in a way to build a team spirit and an atmosphere around his car was a way to get the best people giving their best. I don't know how calculated it was, or because it always felt very natural. After every race, he would, you know, win, lose, or draw, he would come and talk. But if we won, he would, you know, he would share his pleasure in the win with you personally in a way that made you feel that you'd been part of it. And that makes you feel very good and makes you feel like the thing you're doing is much bigger than it actually is.
Could he do things in a racing car that you've seen very few others do?
Certainly.
Can you think of any particular moments?
He was an extremely strong race driver, so he was fit in an era where not everyone was fit and able to thrash out qualifying style laps for a whole race, because back in the days of refueling and on tyres that were pretty robust, he could, you know, that was what was asked of a driver. And he could do that and get out the car without hardly a bead of sweat on him. That level of attention was, I think, unusual. He's also where a lot of drivers don't particularly like testing. You know, Lewis in particular is famous for hating it.
Why does Lewis hate testing so much? Can't he see that the work he puts in...
No, intellectually, he utterly understands it's important, which is why he does it. And he doesn't do it with ill grace. He does it properly. He just knows that it's like the hard yards necessary to do the thing that he loves doing, which is racing. Whereas I think, like, Michael loved training, he loved it. And he liked being at a test track with the team. He would be pushing the team for testing opportunities at every opportunity. I remember one particular year we're in Monaco, we've done Thursday, and he thought, I want some start practice. And at the time, you're allowed a certain number of kilometres to shake down the car during a race weekend or before a race weekend. So he helicoptered himself back to Fiorano, spent Friday doing start practice, and then back to the track on the Saturday.
Yeah.
And he would routinely finish each season as the driver who had spent the most kilometres in the car. This is a person who by then had got championships coming out of his ears and yet still finding the enthusiasm to do that. And I think genuinely because he loved it, you know, the discipline and environment of being a Formula One driver, including all that testing, was just a lifestyle that was right up his alley.
And that's something that's coming across quite strongly in this conversation, is that it's a lifestyle that is right up your alley as well. Is that...
Well, it's certainly been very good to me.
Yeah,
it's been very good to me. There's many, many things to love about it. If I compare myself to my brothers and sisters and look at the careers of the working world they have inhabited, my working world has got a lot going for it. Number one thing is the utter clarity of what we're trying to do. There's no, you know, most companies, I think, they have a range of competing priorities that they're trying to look after, you know, increase sales, look after profits, you know, look after shareholders, whatever. We're just trying to win. And we're trying to make the fastest car with the best operations so that we can win. And everybody from top to bottom in the team, whether they're on the technical side or the commercial side or the operations side, all those people completely get what we're trying to do. And that gives a racing team a sort of unity of purpose that doesn't make you feel like you're in a company. You know, it's called a racing team because it feels like you're a team. And I love that sense of being in a team of people. And I love it the most of all when we do something that's really difficult, where the outcome is very far from certain, and yet somehow we prevail because the wave of emotion that runs through a team that has really given everything, you know, and has punished themselves physically, have skirted a work-life balance at home that is just barely manageable to try and play their part here in this company. When you achieve it, it makes you swell fit to burst with the pleasure of it and the pride and just the sheer buzz of having been part of that.
Are you a very competitive person?
If I was
to take you on the squash court, would it be absolute life and death to you to
not
beat
in sport.
Me?
Not in physical sport. I'm a fairly incompetent sportsman, so I just take for granted I'm going to get beaten by whoever takes me on. I quite liked rugby as a schoolboy and at university, but that's more that I like running around and bashing into people.
But you're such a modest man. You're now going to tell me that you got a blue in rugby or something.
No, I certainly didn't. Okay, no, right. I was lame. Okay. I played for my college team, but no, nothing like that.
So do you have an outlet for that competitive spirit away from... racing, away from Formula One?
Well, I used to do competition aerobatics. That was the main thing I did outside of work that was competitive. But
with success?
With modicum of success, yeah. But compared with the competitiveness of my working environment, everything pales into insignificance. So
you're such a good advert for this team and for what you do. Any of your children likely to follow you into, do they have a sort of engineering bent? They're quite artistic actually, aren't they?
No, my children definitely won't be following me into Formula One. Becca was a singer. She was a professional singer. And my children definitely have a lot of her in them. All of them have a degree of the performer in them that is absent in me. And while there's aspects of my personality they share, they're certainly none of them engineers. My daughter studied languages at university and is very much on the humanities side of the academic spectrum and has my wife's wonderful emotional literacy, something which I sort of picked up by association with my wife, but haven't got anything like her breathtaking skill at. My middle child, Matthew, studies geology, and he's just finishing a master's in geology at the moment, hoping to do a PhD in it, and absolutely loving it. And I guess one of the things that I do see that he's taken from Becca and from me is that attacking whatever he's got in front of him with enthusiasm and taking joy from it is clearly evident. And so that's lovely to see with him. And with Jonathan, my youngest, he has just been accepted to go and study drama at Rose Bruford Drama College, and couldn't be happier for him. I mean,
three high flyers.
Well, they're all three very different, but I'm certainly massively proud of them. They're lovely.
On the language front, after stints at Renault and Ferrari and now at Mercedes, I assume you can speak certainly Italian, am I right?
Only Italian.
So German and French hasn't quite made. You haven't quite
no,
made
I,
it
I'm very. I'm definitely not a talented linguist. But one of the real fun things about working in Italy that first time round was we were all there. Becca, my kids, local schools, living in quite a rural part of Italy, and me working in a part of the team in the aero department that was very much not dominated by English folk. And so learning Italian was both a necessity and a complete thrill, because I'd gone through school adequate at things like English and geography and stuff like that, but really, really pretty good at science-y type things, and had quite early on in my life written off languages as an utter irrelevance and something I couldn't do. And so to find myself later in life actually living and working in Italy, and where I very quickly learned that it was very far from an irrelevance, but also finding that with enough necessity that it was something I could do. And learning Italian was, even to the sort of crappy level I got to, was really, really pleasurable. And the fact that from time to time someone from Raiuno will spring a microphone on me live at a race and start asking me in Italian a bunch of stuff and having to reply on live TV in Italian, that gives me a buzz and makes me feel some pleasure. And certainly living and working in a different culture was a brilliant experience for both Becca and for me.
The whole family. And look, we've been talking about drivers. That's not, we can't talk about drivers and not talk about Valtteri. Would you agree that he's upped his game?
Just look at the results and you can say that he is performing at an extremely high level. I mean, he's 1 point ahead of Lewis, and Lewis is no slouch. But I think it's also worth remembering Valtteri was pretty unlucky by this stage of last season. He should have won Baku. He could so easily have won in China this time last year. And so Valtteri is a pretty bloody good driver. What we've got to see is whether that fortune will keep favouring him and not rob him of points as it did last year, and whether he's going to keep this strong performance as we head into some of the tracks that were more bugbearish to him last year. But the determination that he has this year is extremely evident. And
different to previous?
I think just a degree of focus on the areas of weakness that he had last year. So, you know, he's had a number of poles off of Lewis, even in previous seasons. But on race pace, he had floundered a little at certain races last year. And I think he has worked very hard with his race engineer to understand where that deficit was coming from and to try to moderate his driving style to not damage the tyres in the way that he had done on occasions last year.
2021.
Yeah.
What do you want to see from a technical point of view?
That's a very difficult question. I think the objectives that Liberty have so clearly set out, they are things that anyone who loves this sport would want to see. So the objective of a healthy grid with teams that are putting good equipment on the road, the best drivers, where the racing is close, where overtaking is a feature of the sport, where the spectacle is one that you tune in on a Sunday to watch because you're looking forward to the coup, wow, this is going to be great experience that's in front of you. All of that is stuff that we can all get behind. It's a complicated sport with many, many, many stakeholders and many interests to keep looked after.
So James, finally, you're living life at a fast pace. How long are you going to continue in Formula One? I mean, is it something you're going to do forever, or is a bit like Lewis? As, you know, the last few years we've seen Lewis take interest outside of Formula One with his clothing and everything else he's got going on. Are you starting to have interests outside of Formula One that could eventually pull you away full time?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm living life at a fast pace. I've been doing this for how long? Since 91. So 28 happy, exciting years. And these years, the years where I've been blessed to be a technical director, have been the most interesting of all and have felt like the years of greatest privilege. There's some sense I feel that there are only 10 technical director slots, and the longer that an old git holds on to that post, the less time there is for someone younger to enjoy the fun I've had. But equally, the fun is so massive, you don't want to say goodbye to it any earlier than you have to.
A lot of people would say you're currently the preeminent technical mind in Formula One. How does that make you feel?
That would make me cringe, as we described earlier on, because there are hundreds of people just the other side of the wall in the room we're talking in who would have equal claim on that with me, and in many, many cases, a greater claim, because there are a huge number of really brilliant people in this team alone. And then team by team by team down through the paddock, you see people with similar education, with similar, you know, brain power and skill. So the concept of a preeminent mind is just such nonsense. You know, we all have a certain skill set to bring, and I've been lucky through the sort of arc of my career to be exposed to a bunch of stuff that sort of left me more or less capable of doing the job I currently do. But the job I currently do is just one cog in a machine that's 1,000 people strong. And it's us together that has created this team, a team that I've been lucky enough to join only in the last 2.5 seasons. And so the idea of a preeminent mind just makes my toes curl.
You are incredibly modest, but what is your biggest strength as an engineer then?
Probably communicating and having a slight ability to get people to sort of follow in a direction that we've deemed to be a good one. We being the, you know, a group of decision makers. So I hope adequately persuasive. Relatively articulate. I'm not bad at standing up and speaking to people. I'm pretty good at writing stuff. These are all quite soft skills, you'll note, because pretty much to a person, the engineering community is good at engineering. But as you become more of an engineering leader and less of an engineering doer, then you need to be adept at sort of lining people up behind a challenge. And so that's where communication skills and some of the softer skills come to the fore. So probably more there than that I'm any good at designing wings or gearboxes or any of the billion challenges that the team faces technically.
Well, good luck with that. Thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Inspiring stuff, wasn't it? James is one of the best communicators in F1, and to hear him talk is a bit like listening to a life coach. You come away with ideas about what you can do better in your world, irrespective of the topic. Another thing that makes James different to many of the technical bods in the pit lane is that he's experienced both ends of the engineering spectrum. He's worked for a tiny outfit like LaRousse when getting the car finished was a struggle, and he's worked for the powerhouses of Ferrari and Mercedes. His is a racing book that I'd want to read should he ever write one. Thanks for being so open, James. I loved our chat and hope you did too. And thanks too to Mercedes for being so accommodating. Well, that's it for another week. But as ever, we'll be back in just 7 sleeps with another superstar from the world of F1. In the meantime, as you're waiting for that episode to drop, why not subscribe to Beyond the Grid if you haven't already? We're on all of your favorite podcast apps, including Apple and Spotify. And while you're at it, why not rate us? You know you want to. Talking of rating us, this is our last opportunity to ask for your vote ahead of the British Podcast Awards. We've been nominated for 2 gongs, so if you like what we do, we'd love your vote. Please visit britishpodcastawards.com/vote to register your vote. And thanks for your messages about last week's show with Damon Hill. There's a lot of love out there for the 1996 world champion, but this message from Thermal caught my eye. Thank you for another amazing podcast, writes Thermal. I never was a big fan of Damon as a driver because I didn't know much about him. But what a nice and humble guy he is shows you how much a simple podcast can make a difference. Well, indeed it does. Thanks, Thermal. And please keep your feedback coming. We love it. Use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid and you can tweet me at TomClarksonF1. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audio Boom. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.